Hello, everyone. Welcome to another episode of GTI Insights, Global Taiwan Institute's policy podcast. My name is Marshall Reed, and I'm a program manager here with GTI.
And I'm Adrian Wu, a research associate at GTI.
And to kick off our fifth season of GTI Insights, we're really so fortunate to be joined by Kira Rudik, a member of Ukrainian parliament and a leader of the Holos Party. Since her election in 2019, Rudik has really strongly argued for expanding Ukraine's ties with democracies around the world and reinforcing the international rules-based order. In addition to her role in Kyiv, she also serves as the vice president of the Alliance of Liberals and Democrats for Europe and is the first individual from a non-European Union country to hold that position. Prior to her election, she held a variety of roles in the technology industry both in Europe and in the United States, including serving as the chief operating officer for Ring Ukraine. She's been a tireless advocate for Ukraine on the global stage and has really played a critical role in building international support for her country's fight against Russia's invasion. Perhaps most notably for today's conversation, Rudik has also become a leading proponent of Ukraine-Taiwan ties, becoming the first member of Ukraine's parliament to visit Taiwan. Since the start of Russia's full-scale invasion in 2022, she's really worked closely with Taiwanese partners to facilitate people-to-people ties and parliamentary ties between the two democracies, and has frequently linked their shared struggle against authoritarian aggression. So with all this in mind, Adrian and I were really thrilled to be able to sit down with Kira to discuss her political work, her passion projects, and her efforts to build ties with Taiwan. Well, Kira, we want to start by thanking you for taking the time to speak with us today, particularly at such a difficult and complex time for Ukraine. As I'm sure so many of our listeners are aware, we're fast approaching the second anniversary of Russia's unprovoked invasion of Ukraine in February of 2022, as well as the 10th anniversary of Moscow's 2014 of seizure of Crimea. Since the start of the invasion, you've repeatedly drawn contrast between Ukraine's democratically elected government and Russia's highly authoritarian system under Vladimir Putin, framing the conflict as a, quote, war for civilization and democracy. Could you elaborate a bit on this statement? Why is the war in Ukraine so important, not just for Ukraine, but for democracies around the world?
Hello, thank you so much for having me. And thank you for keeping Ukraine on top of the news, because it is so important for us right now when the world is concentrated on so many things. The war is still here and the war continues happening. So back to your question, it is a war between civilizations and between the views, between authoritarian regime and the democracy. We are fighting against the precedent because you see the world didn't have a major war for almost 100 years. And this is why there are so many countries that forgot what it is to fight for your freedoms and got this illusion that freedom is free. And authoritarian regimes have gathered their powers and now they are looking of how much they can push. And does the West mean business when they are saying, oh, there will be sanctions, oh, there will be repercussions? We are right now fighting against the precedent that in 21st century, one country can annex the territory of another one, commit all kinds of the war crimes from the war crimes list, and then get away with this. Add our territories to their constitution, break all the international laws, and then continue business as usual. This is exactly what we are fighting against. We are saying, no, it is not possible. When we are looking at what Russia is afraid of, they are afraid of an example of a free, democratic country that was at some point under their influence and then made their own decision, decided to join EU and NATO rather than joining alliances with Russia, decided that we do have our own language, our own history, and that we are able to define our own future. And the main difference is that we are seeing our future in future. And if you listen to Vladimir Putin, he is always referring to the past and he is trying to drag the country and all the other countries to the past. He is either rebuilding Russian Empire or he is rebuilding Soviet Union. And now he is saying that Russia indeed has no borders, which makes Ukraine, Poland, all the Baltic countries really squeak.
Yeah, thank you so much for going into that. And and really talking so passionately about your support for democracy. And, you know, since you were first elected in 2019, you strongly emphasized Ukraine's democratic system and role in the international democratic movement. So what led you to make democratic governance such a central part of your platform as a politician? And why is it so important for Ukraine to safeguard its own democratic system, not only just for its own citizens, but also to collaborate with other democracies worldwide?
Well, the democracy is good because as of right now, it's the best way of governing that people have defined. Simple as that. And if you get people, allow them to choose, they choose democracy because they look at the countries that they want to be like, and they see that the successful countries, prosperous countries, when all the people are getting the benefits of the country's prosperity and not just a clique and a like small list of the selected ones. These are all democracies that are being successful. And this is why when you even like looking, okay, well, we want to repeat the path of the United States, of Britain or Poland. These are all democracies. And you know what is the most interesting? Well, if you look at the authoritarian regimes, countries like Russia or Iran or North Korea, you will see that they are all very patriotic when they're talking to their citizens. But the kids are studying in London and United States. Their wives are shopping in the European cities, and they all have villas somewhere at the Côte d'Azur, right? And they do not choose to live their actual life at the societies that they have built, at the regime that they have built. They are looking at the prosperity of the countries that they despise. And if it was not this way, we could have argued like which way is the best, but we know which way is the best by the actions of the authoritarians through all over the world who are definitely choosing democracies. Moreover, and this is something that I'm absolutely passionate about, and I have spent the last 2 years working on this. It is a matter of rule of law. So if Russia, as of right now, has $500 billion of Russian money stored in the democratic countries that they despise so much, they store them there because they hope that the rule of law will prevent this money from being confiscated. And they feel very safe and secure. And this is why they have their money in democratic countries and not in some other authoritarian regimes, right? So the good way to show Russia and all the other authoritarian regimes that are looking at starting the war anywhere or resolving any ongoing conflict with the power is show them the West means business and go ahead and confiscate the money that are being, first of all, illegally acquired and then illegally used.
Well, I think that's a great point you make, that authoritarian regimes like the one in Russia are very much rooted in the past. They're very focused on sort of rebuilding these past glories and rebuilding these past empires, whether it's the Soviet Union or the Russian Empire. And like you said, this is not something that's unique to Russia. This is something that authoritarian regimes around the world do to justify their behavior and justify their claims on other sovereign states' territory. So I want to turn down to another situation that's unfolding in, unfortunately, a very similar way, in which a democratic state is being menaced by a revanchist authoritarian state, which is Taiwan, which faces a very similar regime in Beijing, which is very focused on rebuilding these past empires and reclaiming these past glories. You know, for several years now, you've really forcefully advocated for expanded ties between Ukraine and Taiwan, and have really led the way in that. So what is it that's drawn you to Taiwan? What is it about Taiwan that has made you reach out and travel to Taiwan and try to build these sort of people-to-people ties and these affinities between Ukrainians and Taiwanese people?
Well, there is a funny and very simple answer to what drew me to Taiwan, at Nancy Pelosi. I met her on the first day, for the first year of the full-scale invasion. I've been to Washington, D.C., and she was still at the office, and I had a huge pleasure on meeting her and have a discussion on what can I do as a politician and as a person to strengthen the support for Ukraine throughout the world. And she said, you should be looking at the allies that are at the same situation as you are, and that will be interested to supporting you in creating this precedent that one country cannot attack another one. And this is how I got the connection with a couple of colleagues from the Parliament of Taiwan, and this is how I came to visit. And I fell in love with the country, and I, of course, fell in love with, you know, this urge for freedom that people have. There are so much things that we have in common, and there is so much things that we had to discuss, and we are still working very closely. Every time I'm meeting from some of the high-level officials from Taiwan, and we hug and we like exchange gifts, small souvenirs, and then I say, I try to lower the emotion down, saying, okay, let's be pragmatic. You are interested in us the same way we are interested in you. And it's like, you know, breaks the ice in the room if there is an ice, because everybody starts laughing and saying like, well, no, you know that it's like bigger than that. And I say, well, you know, exactly. It is bigger than that. It's bigger than us. There is one thing that really struck me. It was after my visit, Minister of Foreign Affairs contacted me and decided to donate $1 million to Kyiv, where I'm living. So to help us to survive through the winter. And it was so incredible because we bought generators for children's hospitals and kindergartens. And we really indeed survived through the winter by that. And I was thinking of how many people from like literally another part of the world, like another side of the world, would have this feeling of unity, of solidarity, that they would go ahead and do something like that. Since that time, there was lots of waves of support from Taiwan, and we appreciate it so much. You know, 2 days ago, there was a major attack on Kyiv, and one of the missiles hit the building near where I live, and my windows on both floors were pulled out of their frames, and they were destroyed, and my house became a mess. And it was such a terrifying experience because I never had any missile strike so close to where I live. And I feel I had got only minor injuries, but my neighbors were severely injured. And so when we came to the place where the hit happened, to the crater, there were like many emergency services that were helping out. And you know, when you're looking at the pictures from the terrorist attacks like this, you always see the rubble, you see the people. There is one thing that you usually don't notice, but it is so critically important. It's the emergency cars and trucks. And it is critical because you need at single point, you need many of them. You need like 20, 50, because you need many people to be taken from the top floors or people to be taken to the ambulances. You need many fire trucks. And this is what Taiwan gave us, almost 50 cars that were transferred from another side of the world to Ukraine this year. And we were able to donate them to many cities, not just Kyiv. And I know that they are doing good right now. But and so this is one of the ways of explaining you how important these ties are and how critical it is for us to keep it and how grateful we are. And I make sure that people in Ukraine know about this, know about Taiwan, know that we have friends on the other side of the world that are struggling with the similar issues and that really want us to win the war and really want to help us to do this.
Yeah, thank you so much for sharing such a personal and deep story. I think that, you know, it really shows how important these ties are and how connected we are as people and, you know, how we can help other people just from a humanitarian basic position. So, but also talking about Ukraine and Taiwan's similarities. So following the Russian invasion in 2022, a lot of commentators have rushed to compare the conflict with a potential Chinese invasion of Taiwan. So do you think that there is value in comparing these two situations? Do you see parallels or linkages between the two? And what are some of the opportunities or challenges in comparing these two?
Well, as I said, I think the results of the war in Ukraine. And I strongly believe and fighting for that these will be positive results for us. But whatever they are, will have a strong impact on the actions of all the other countries that really want to take a chunk of their neighbors. And it will not only rely on how the military solution worked and how bravely we fight and how we fight back and what technologies we use, etc., but also the decisions and the actions of the West, of NATO, and of all our allies. That would mean a lot. Because I remember it precisely before the full-scale invasion started, there were so many Western leaders who were threatening Russia with sanctions. And Russian position was very clear, like, you will never go ahead with it, or your sanctions would not work. Or there was another thing they said, well, or your unity would not last. And it is happening right now, the check from Russia side, from all the other authoritarian regimes throughout the world side, like saying, okay, well, so what's happening? Was Russia right or not? And they are watching so precisely. They're watching very closely on what is happening. Which countries are trying to avoid sanctions? Which countries are helping out with secondhand sanctions? Which countries are trying to, like, helping to omit one? Which countries make public statements and which are trying to remain neutral? How their leadership is changing in the certain democracies, and is it becoming more supportive of Russia or more supportive of Ukraine? And all these things, it's just like, you know, it's a triad if it's possible or not. And this is what I'm trying to explain to all my colleagues throughout the democratic countries. It's not only about Ukraine. If you are, your steps are weak, you are procrastinate here, then you will have to deal with so many other, and it will be very hard to persuade China that, oh, we will act differently if it will be you. No, it's a matter of precedent. And again, it's a matter of setting up the reactions on the international level that would stop any possible ideas of invading other countries. And I'm coming back to my favorite topic of confiscation assets. Like, if you're looking at where Iran is saving their money, if you're looking like in China investments, it will be a very bold move to say, while you are acting within the international law, you're good. The moment you start full-scale invasion, all the discussions, all the agreements are off the table. So please behave. And I think this is why it is so important for us to get all the support we need, because the results, they will be historic, not only for Ukraine, but they will be historic for so many other countries. You know, I speak a lot with my colleagues in Taiwan, and I'm trying to share this feeling of what would we have done differently if we knew for sure that Russia would attack. But the issue is, and it will always probably will be, when you are sitting in a peaceful city, it's very hard to persuade people that it could change like this. However, I think it's never early to build bomb shelters. And I'm so terrified that in 21st century, I have to say something like this, because honestly, we are going away from the world that we wanted to build for our kids, right? Peaceful world where everyone has an opportunities and equal possibilities and is empowered to pursue their dreams. So this is the saying, build more bomb shelters is directing away from that. But that could have been really life-saving for us at the first months of the full-scale invasion. You know, there is another side of all of this, it's sanctions. Russia is able to produce weapons and supplies in the scale that they are able to do because the West made it a little bit more expensive for them to produce and to get the parts that they need, but they did not close all the doors. And it is important to realize that until it is done, it will be a never-ending story. Because Russia is a huge country. They do have lots of resources. They are larger than us, and they have more people, and they have more money. And our chances are in being more agile, more technological, more motivated. It's always, and like this is the main similarity, is it's David versus Goliath situation. Same for Taiwan, that you have to have chances in this fight. You have to be smarter, you have to be faster, you have to be more prepared, and you have to have better friends. You have to have allies that will stand by you. And this is the main question that we have of 2024 is, like, are we still all together? Are we still standing? Are we still fighting? Are we still, like, getting the support that we need? Or, like, is everybody concentrated on their own stuff? And then, like, everybody is by themselves. So I think we are a living proof that you can be very brave, but you cannot fight the war alone. And that you can be only successful to the point that we are successful when you have strong allies that are able to support you, especially when it comes to the military equipment, to the weapons, to the missiles, something that Ukraine does not produce. And here we come to the incredibly painful moment in our history, which is called Budapest Memorandum, when Ukraine gave up on our second largest nuclear arsenal in the world for the promises of protection of our sovereignty done by United States, Britain, I think France and Russia. And it was written, and we did indeed give up on our nuclear arsenal. And here is what is happening right now. So it is incredibly important to move past the story and say, well, it was then, and now everyone stepped up and supported you. Otherwise, it's in, again, we are moved as a world, as a democratic Western world, and we are going into a different direction, which is saying, if you don't have nuclear, then you are a target, then you are a victim. And this will only push countries to work on their nuclear programs, only push countries to figure out a ways of defending themselves. So 2024 will be a year when the alliances will be challenged. And we need to make sure that Putin fails at his hope that the unity of the West will not last.
Well, I'm glad you brought our conversation into 2024, because I want to use this final question to just look forward a little bit. I know it's always difficult to forecast, and it's doubly hard in a year as potentially tumultuous as 2024. But given your interest in Taiwan and your interest in safeguarding democracies around the world and building ties between democracies, what are some lessons that democracies, including Taiwan, can take from Ukraine? And what are some lessons that Ukraine can take from other democracies, particularly Taiwan?
Oh, it's very simple, honestly. The main lesson that Ukraine can learn from Taiwan is build the sophisticated production and rely on yourself, and that will protect you better than anything else. If you have the high-end technologies, you will be ahead all the time. And the lessons that I'm sharing with our Taiwanese colleagues is better be prepared than sorry. If you have political agreements, have them signed and sealed in advance. It's not a bad idea to have a medical training for most of the population. It's not a bad idea to do the fire trainings, like how to exit the buildings. And again, in Ukraine, seeing how much we evolved in 2 years, and this is tragic to say that, oh, our kids know how to act during the air raid siren right now, or they know how to get into the bomb shelter, on how to cover their heads with their palms. It's tragic to say that, but that is life-saving. And we know in 2 years, we are much better than at the very beginning. And it means less victims at the most terrifying events. It tells us that you have to be very, very decisive. It's nobody's good solution to say, well, we will be somewhere in the middle. This is where the authoritarian regime is watching it at you as a target, because you did not make it very clear. You thought that you may be friends with everyone, etc. It cannot be like that. This is what we learned the hard way. And thank you for reminding us that the war did not start in 2022. It started in 2014, when Ukraine made a decision that we are going to the EU and we are going to join NATO, and Russia really did not like it. So from having like the neutral position to having defined position, this is what made the aggressor like go a step ahead. But it doesn't mean that we should stop aiming where we are. And it is written in our constitution right now that we want to join NATO and we want to join EU. And this is where we are going to go. But moving forward, I realize how hard it is when you are not surrounded by allies. And this is where you have to figure out and fight for every single ally that you can get. And while we are here, I want to thank Taiwan again for a quick and swift sanctions policy on selling chips to Russia right away, without, like, we did not even start reaching out when it was already done. And for that, I'm so thankful. So I cannot comment anything on the elections, obviously, but I can say that people who are leading the country need to be decisive.
Well, Kira, I think that's a great place to bring this conversation to a close. You know, I think you've done a great job of providing so much context on what's happening on the ground in Ukraine and letting all of our listeners know why it's so important for democracies around the world. This is not an isolated conflict. This is not limited to Ukraine's borders, but has implications for democracies around the world, for states around the world, whether it's in Western Europe, Eastern Europe, or in East Asia. And, you know, while I think you would agree that there's a lot of differences between Taiwan and Ukraine, they're not the same. They face very different circumstances. There are parallels, as you've made clear. And just like Ukraine, Taiwan is facing an authoritarian power that looks to sort of reclaim this imperial past, much like Russia. And there's a lot to learn from Ukraine's experience, from its successes, from its failures. And I think you've done such a good job providing so much nuance and so much interesting context. So thank you so much for joining us. We've been so impressed from here in DC, what you've been doing in Ukraine, what your party's been doing, and what Ukraine has been doing more broadly to resist Russia. So we thank you so much for joining us at this difficult time, and we're so excited to be able to talk to you.
Thank you so much, and glory to Ukraine.
And thank you to all our listeners for joining us for another episode of GTI Insights. Many thanks also to the great staff and interns at GTI for all their help with every step of producing this podcast. If you're interested in learning more about GTI, be sure to check out our website at globaltaiwan.org, where you can find information about our Global Taiwan Brief, our longer publications, and our frequent public seminars. You can also listen to more episodes of GTI Insights on Spotify, Google Podcasts, or wherever else you get your podcasts. Until next time, this has been GTI Insights.